Good afternoon. So today we're going to cover exam review, but first to remind you about what we talked about on Thursday. So on Thursday we introduced the concept of a hardware description language, which is like a programming language, but instead of compiling to something like assembly, we compile to a description of a circuit that we can build. So the instructions on how to build an actual circuit that implements it. And because of that, our hardware description language does things that are different than you would see in a programming language meant to compile to assembly. We also talked more about our textbook's idea of stages. And the stages in our textbook, we mentioned, were not the order things actually happen. In our physical processor, we have a clock signal that determines when things are written, and this includes the PC, the register values in the register file, and the data memory, and the condition codes. And these all happen, are put in their respective stages, but they all update at one time. So the stages were about, you know, it's easier to figure out how we wire up our processor, what instructions do you stage by stage. That's their utility at this point in the course. Later on in the course, we'll have a bigger reason for having stages. But for now, they're just a way of dividing up the work of the processor. They have some relationship to when things happen. For example, you can't add two values from registers until you read them from registers. But they don't actually determine the order in which things happen or match the order in which everything happens. Okay, so some logistical notes before I get to exam review. So about office hour locations. So on the calendar, some of our office hours have a location specified. For example, this says Rice Hall, room 436, and there's at least one other case where the office hours are not in Thornton Stacks. So please check, especially if you go to Stacks and wonder where is the TA, why is the queue not up? That might be related. If more than one person has made this mistake, that's why I'm pointing it out. On the homework, so something which was not obvious to everyone, though most people took advantage of this, is that you can use multiple statements and temporary variables. This is part of the subset of C we allow you to use, and it makes it a lot easier to do the problems. It is technically possible to solve all the problems in the operation limit without doing this, but much, much, much harder. Also, only arithmetic strips are available. Because so we weren't very careful in making the tool that you're using to implement this subset of C, it lets you declare unsigned variables, but the unsignedness is ignored. They just always act as signed. In a future semester, I will edit that to just not allow that. But I couldn't do it now because some people have solutions which use unsigned variables and they expect them to continue working. So not going to change it in the middle, even though it's confusing that you don't get logical shifts. Also, let's talk about a few things on this week's quiz. So first, I'll talk about this first question here. So we have about what is an alternative to the design decision our textbook authors made for IRMoveQ. And that decision was, we're gonna, for IRMoveQ, have the ALU add zero to something. The something they're adding zero to is the value from the instruction. They made this decision because this is a bit less work overall because MRMoveQ needs to add something to the value from the instruction, so we're kind of reusing some stuff. And an alternate decision we could have made is we could have said, why bother adding zero to a value from the instruction to get the same value? Let's just send it directly where it needs to go. And for IRMoveQ, where it needs to go is the register file. So you could have sent it directly there instead of having this option to add zero to it. I'll also go over the most gotten wrong question on here, which is about PopQ. So what address is passed to the data memory during PopQ? So what address are we reading? And there are two logical options here. So we have an address, we get an address from the register file during this instruction. That's the address in the stack pointer. We also have an address coming out of the ALU. That's the address we're computing to update the stack pointer. And you need to ask, which one of these do we want? Do we want the address of the stack pointer as it is before this instruction started, or the address we're going to update it to? And if you remember how pop works, which you could have looked up, and I think we will mention somewhere on exams if you need it, the way pop works is that you read memory from where the stack pointer points now, and then update it to point above that. And that means that we get the value from the register file, not the new stack pointer, which is the new top of the stack and not the location we're trying to read. It's the next thing on the stack, not the value we're popping off. Yes? So the question is, does the value of RSP and the value it's being popped into, the register it's being popped into, change at the same time? Yes. And if you remember, our textbook talked about this principle of no reading back. Because everything happens in a single cycle and all the writes happen at the end of the cycle, we can't write a value and read it. So it doesn't matter. So if we're reading a value from the register file, it's always the old value, if it comes from there. So any other questions about the quiz? Yes? Okay, so can I go over this exercise? So let me copy this down. So we have XA equals YA plus YB, and XB equals YB plus 1. Okay, so that's what this does. So we have four values. We have XA, XB, and YA, YB. So these are the outputs of registers, and these are the inputs. And we're told that initially these are 0 and 0. And so we need to figure out what the rest are. And we can figure out what XA and XB are just by reading these statements. So XA is YA plus YB, that's 0 plus 0 is 0. XB is YB plus 1, 0 plus 1 is 1. So then we need to figure out what happens as the clock advances. So after one rising edge of the clock, we need to remember, what do registers do after a rising edge? So this is represents our rising edge. And if you remember, what registers do is they copy their input to their output. So the input here gets copied to the output for each of the two registers. So we have 0 and 1 here, and we do the same procedure. We look at the statements to figure out what the inputs are. So XA is YA plus YB, that's going to be 0 plus 1 is 1, XB is YB plus 1 is 2. And we can apply the same procedure. So 2 gets copied to the output, 1 gets copied to the output, XA is the sum, and XB is 2 plus 1. And then we're asked, so this is after one rising edge, after two, after three, value gets copied, and you were asked for, I think, this value. So you have that. And when solving a problem like this, I highly recommend writing out this table so you don't make an off by one error. I know I will if I don't write out a table like this. So any other questions about the quiz or what I wrote up here? Okay, so apparently not. So I believe that leads us to the question portion of this. So I will take things you want me to review for about the exam, or any questions about the exam. I'll just take all the questions now, and then I'll put them in some order and answer them, ideally category by category. So I'll just give me questions. Yeah. Okay, what's on the exam? Okay. Anything else? Other questions? Yeah.
Number 6 on the fall 2016.
Okay, F2016, number 6, and you can tell me basic what type of question that is?
Yes, yeah, so it says like there's a sign chart containing the value of -33 parentheses, some number, and then you're doing some unsigned comparison with that sign chart.
Okay, signed, unsigned comparison. Okay, yeah. Which is basically about?
It's like about
ALU. ALU what?
And
ALU and registers.
It's like, yeah, it's like a circuit.
ALU and registers circuit, okay. Yeah. Okay. Ways to study. Okay. Okay, object files. Okay, other things, yeah.
Can you maybe just do like an example of when we'll have to determine where to put boxes based on like
placing boxes, okay. Yeah.
Like how much approximately of a test involves like reading code and like figuring out what's going on and stuff like that.
Okay. Okay. Other things, yeah.
Yeah, my question is more general. Like, there was a lot of questions on the exams about IEEE floating point standards.
Okay, floating point. I'll get there, yeah. Other thing, questions, things you'd like me to cover?
Spring 2017, number 20.
Number 20, which is about?
Extracting the RB field
from instruction in C, right? Okay. Any other questions before I just go into them, and it's going to be a while before I'll solicit more. Yeah. Okay, bitwise sort of true-false strategies. Okay. Okay, so let's group these up here. Okay, so, yeah.
Yeah, can we also go over overflow as well?
Overflow. Any particular context? Just
general? Yeah, like overflow comparisons. There were a lot of examples in the exams where it's like comparing to things like, oh, this is a case where it overflows. Like, that's actually.
And, okay. and overflow, okay. Okay. What's happening in lab? Anything else? Yes.
Ranges versus like a sexual.
Okay. Lists and C. Okay. Yeah.
Things relating to Y and 63.
Any, can you be more specific?
like any distinct differences between 9 and x86.
Okay, Y86 versus x86. Okay. Yeah.
Can you go over risk versus CISC?
Risk versus CISC? Okay, these are probably together. Yeah.
Can you delete anything that's not?
We'll talk about what's the first question is what's on the exam, so we'll get there. But I'm collecting questions first, and then we're gonna go through everything. Yeah.
Ternary operators.
Ternary operator, okay. Anything else? Or reset for now. Okay. So what's on the exam? So if it's been covered in lecture, lab, homeworks, so except not command line stuff, that's just so you can do labs more efficiently, and no writing HCL, no asking what's valid or invalid HCL. Other than that, it could be on the exam. How much reading code? There will be some assembly and C. C, not more than 5 or 6 lines at most. 5 or 6 lines of assembly, like 1, 2, 3 lines of C. This is approximate. We will remind you about any strange assembly instructions. Yeah.
So, like, the question on the quiz where it was like, what will the value of like YA for the HCL question? That's not going to be on the quiz, or is that your
name? We could ask that. I said no. Writing HCL, reading is fine. Okay. Like, we won't ask you. So we might ask. We might do that instead of drawing the circuit. Yeah. But we won't ask you like, is this valid HCL or anything like that. And we're not going to write any HCL cases where there's something tricky where it's not, where it doesn't do the most obvious thing you'd expect it to do because of some obscure rule like why are wits work something strangely or something like that. So floating point is not something we covered, so it's not on the exam. Yes.
Like how much of that do we need to
know? So I can say, and it's more specifically, no names of built-in signals. So that's probably what you're thinking of memorizing. Yeah. No names of built-in signals or constants. If we give you HCL, it's going to be something like on the quiz, where everything's in there. With the, no, on the quiz with the register, YA, YB.
Okay.
Yeah, where everything is there. For the signals built into HCL, we assume you're going to refer to the manual every time you do it. Yeah?
Should we consider what?
Oh, yeah, so technically the readings would be included. I think everything that's relevant of the readings is covered in lecture. That might not be strictly true. Okay, what's happening in lab? Lab is exam review. We aren't checking attendance. Checking attendance, but you can ask questions about the exam. And there will be TAs there to answer that. So that you might want to take advantage of that. Ways to study. So sort of best practice is prior exams, caveats, some questions aren't relevant anymore or aren't written great well. But the best sort of most representative of what we'll ask is prior exams. Also good are prior quizzes and, you know, maybe textbook exercises and sort of, you know, there's also sort of standard things like make up your own problems and solve them as a way to study if you want to do that sort of thing, if you want to do things besides just going through your notes, which maybe some people find effective, some people don't, but that would be my, these sorts of things would be my recommendation for studying. Yes?
What topics that have been taught in the past are not taught now? Like, what should we look at?
The biggest one is floating point. There are some other cases where, like, we may have covered some topics in a little more depth in some semesters than now. Like last semester we covered a little more risk versus CISC stuff than we did this semester. But also, some of the prior semesters we used a 32-bit version of Y86. So there's instructions which like RM move L instead of RM move Q, which is obviously we won't use RM move L because we aren't using 32-bit Y86. So there's some differences like that. So any questions about logistics? Okay. So signed, unsigned comparison. Let's see if I can quickly pull up the old exam. Where is it? Yes, and that is fall 2016. Pull up the question. It was question number 6, so that would be here. So we have a signed char containing negative 33, and we convert it to an unsigned char with a cast. And the question asks which of these things are true. I don't like asking this sort of trivia, but the general rule is that when we do a comparison, the compiler first converts both values to the same type. And that type is usually at least as big as an int. So this comparison is going to be done with ints ultimately. So in the first case, we take x and we either convert it to an int implicitly or explicitly. We should get the same result either way. That should be true. Especially since every possible value of a signed char can fit in an int. So the conversion doesn't lose any information. In the second case, we're going to have different values when we convert unsigned char to an int and signed char to an int. But all the possible values of both fit in an int, and they have different values even though it's the same bit pattern. So we're going to get false. For the next one, we know that we're starting with an unsigned number and we're shifting it over by 1, and that's going to be dividing by 2, which is going to make it smaller, so it should be true. In the second case, we're starting with a negative number, and we're shifting it over by 1. Since this is a signed number, we're doing an arithmetic shift. So that's going to be dividing by 2 also, but it's dividing a negative number by 2, so it's not going to get small. It's going to get closer to 0, which is larger. So that's false. People look a little confused. Oh, why is unsigned? Sorry, I had C and D reversed.
Okay.
The signed one is negative. The unsigned one is obviously not negative.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also think it was a little confusing if it was like negative 33, but then like parentheses.
So that converts it to an unsigned char.
Right. Yeah, I didn't know the number that they had in parentheses was actually negative 33. Yeah, I just thought they were trying to subtract that number.
Okay, yeah. I mean, literally, that's negative 33, which has that bit pattern. Okay, other questions about this example? Okay, then we have a question about 16. Here, which is this one. Okay, so we have this circuit. I'll redraw this somewhere where I can easily write. So we have something like an ALU, which always does an add, and we have A, B, two registers, and we do this. So that's what we have, if you apologize for my handwriting. So, and we learn from the question that it's initially 1. And we asked about after three realizing inches of the clock. So this is similar to our quiz question. So we're asking, what is the register A and B, so output, and we also want to figure out the input, which is going to be the output in the next cycle. So the output of A is initially, and B are both 1, initially, which means the input of B is 1, because this wire goes to B. And the input of A is the sum of the two outputs, which is 2. So then after one rising edge of the clock, we get 2 here. Well, that's 2. So we get 2 and 1, and then we can do the same thing as far as figuring out if A is outputting 2, what's the input to B? It's 2. If B is outputting 1 and A is outputting 2, what's the input to A? It's 2 plus 1 is 3. 2. And same procedure. So we have 3 as the input to B and 5. And I think it asked what the output is, so that's our answer. And if you observe what we're doing here, this circuit actually, yes? After the third rising edge. Oh. So this is after one rising edge, this is after 2, this is after 3. The numbering here is the number of rising edges that have happened. Since the horizontal lines represent a rising edge of the clock. If you look carefully, you can figure out that this circuit actually computes Fibonacci sequence. Okay. Any questions about this? So again, I recommend writing things out like this because otherwise I'm bound to make an off by one error. Here I can at least check how many rising edges of the clock is it the 3 that I need, and I'm looking after it relatively easily. Okay. So the next thing on our list is object files. So what's in an object file? So an assembly file, I'll start with that, contains assembly code with labels, labels within instructions and marking instructions, and also contains data like the initial value of global variables, etc. Constant global variables, constants, etc. The object file contains machine code for the assembly with placeholders for labels within instructions, with symbol table of labels that mark an instruction, that tell you where an instruction you want to refer to. Mark an instruction or mark data, which is the other thing labels can do, like e.g. a constant. Constant. And contains data, constant data, same data from assembly file. And the executable file contains machine code and initial data to load directly into memory. So placeholders replaced with actual addresses needed. And yes, I will post this text file one after lecture, so. I know, yeah.
So can you go over the question on the first quiz?
OK, so the question is, on our first quiz, we had a question about object files. So if I go to, was it 01? 00. 00, okay. So, ask question here is which of the following is true? So does it contain the names of labels? We said we had to store placeholders and also where a symbol table saying where labels refer to when we had them marking an instruction or a piece of data. And to encode the labels in that, we need the names, because if we have another object file, we use the name, we don't use something else. So the second part is, it includes information about where memory addresses will be. Those are the placeholders. That's a description of what the placeholders are. They're, where do we need to put a memory address when we actually produce the executable? You know, and that's going to be based on the name of a label or something about a label that we need to encode for the machine code or something like that. Also, we have this option about, it includes information about where each instruction starts. We don't care. We have everything we need to know to produce the executable. We don't need anything else. We don't actually need to know where each instruction is to create the executable to load into memory. The processor obviously is going to figure that out as it runs the program, but there's no reason to have that in the assembly file. That's not something the linker needs to worry about. It only needs to worry about where the placeholders are and where the symbol table says things are. Yes? Mm-hmm. So the question is, what's different between main and what this says? So this question asserts that we have where each instruction starts. So certainly we have to know like where functions start, because we call them. But we don't need to know where every single instruction is. Anything else about assembly object files or any other part of the sort of compilation process? Okay. So about placing muxes. So a sort of a general strategy is, what do my inputs need to be? If there are multiple choices, there needs to be a mux. Be a mux. If there's another choice, there's an additional choice, need a mux with more inputs. So for example, if I say, let's take an example from a prior exam, which was IAM move queue. So this is an instruction which does something like, we have this writes to memory at address REX plus 0, the value 100. So let's think about, what is the input to the data memory look like for this? Does anything need to change? So to figure that out, first we want to figure out what is the input to the, before, what is the input to the data memory have? What are our options? What do we need? So what do instructions need to supply to the data memory? What values? So we should just go through the instructions. So we have not, nothing, not, add, a whole bunch of other instructions which don't do anything with the data memory. Then we have to worry about what are instructions which change the data memory, which input a sort of the, let's say the value input, so that, which write to the data memory. So what instructions do we have that write? So the obvious one is RM move queue. That's an instruction which writes. We have a couple others. So you think, does push write? Yes, it does. Pop? Nope, doesn't write, it reads. Does call write? Yes, it does. Return reads. Call. Or others. So RM move queue writes value from a register, means register file output. So that's where it's connected from. Push queue also writes a value from a register. And call writes PC+10. So one conclusion we can make from this is that we must already have a mux in front of this input, because we have two completely unrelated values depending on the instruction we need to pass into the data memory's value input. either PC plus 10 or that. And then we can say, after we have this additional everything else plus, IMoveQ is constant from the instruction is it, that's part of what the instruction memory is outputting. So that's where we get what's in the instruction. And that's indeed not one of these other options. Doesn't not already a possible input need to add something to the mux here, That makes sense. So this general strategy is how you can reason about it. So you want to know, what do we need there? You think, what's the, for all my instructions, what do I need to supply here? For all our Y86 instructions, what needs to happen at this part of the processor? Where do we get the, in this case, the value input? You can do the same thing for the address input. Where does it come from? How is the address computed? Do we even use it? You can do the same thing like for the ALU. What is the ALU doing during each of these instructions? And that's sort of the reasoning, and you can figure out what happens for each instruction and which ones are the same. If everything's the same, you don't need a mux. If everything does the same thing, can do the same thing, you don't need a mux. If there are multiple choices you need to make, then you're going to need to have a mux there. And you're going to need to have an input for each possible choice. So, any questions about this? This is before adding IMoveQ and after adding IMoveQ. The hypothetical here, which I didn't set up clearly, is hypothetical adding a new IMoveQ instruction. What changes about muxes? Like, if you wanted to figure that out, like how would you do that? I could have also gone into if we had like a subset of our processor and added something, but that's more work to set up. So any questions about manipulating muxes? Okay, so question here, extracting RBE from an instruction in C. So I believe the setup of this question was we had an unsigned char star pointing to our instruction, and we wanted to get RBE. And if we remember our instruction layout, which I believe was given in the question, we have the most significant bits, byte one, our I code, the least significant bits of byte one are the I fun, and the most significant bits, I should say zero, the first byte, one are RA, and the least significant bits of byte one are RB. So this is what our instructions which take registers look like at the beginning. And I believe in this question was given to you because this is not about memorizing that table completely and getting the order right. The question is, given this unsigned char star, how do we actually get at this value here, which is the least significant bits of RB? We can apply the same principle. So first thing we need to do is we want to get this whole thing here, which is the byte. So byte one is if instruction is instruction of index one, because we want to advance one byte in memory from the beginning of the instruction to get there. So that's the value of the whole byte with two different pieces. And each of these, and this byte is 8 bits wide, and it has 2 4-bit pieces, and we want to separate the two. So our general procedure, just when we're doing bit manipulation, is So usually shift and mask. So first we want to shift the value we want to the bottom of the number. So we want it in the least significant bits of the number, and look, it's already there. So it's already at the bottom of the number, and then we do masking. We write a number where we have ones in every place where we want to keep the bits, and zeros elsewhere. We can end with that, and that's how we can choose what bits we want to keep, and it's very handy for that. And so our mask is going to look like this. This is the ones we don't keep, and the least significant bits are the ones we want to keep. So that's our mask in binary, and this is looks like is OXOF and hexadecimal. So we want to AND with that mask. So we shift over 0 because we're already there, which is the same thing as not shifting, and AND with that mask, which is the same thing as just ending with that mask directly. Yes? Was it RB and not RA? Was it RB and not RA? Let me pull up the test. So there are other ways of doing this, which is probably what happens on the test, and that was spring 2017. XM2 1J. Okay. Was this question 20? I think the correct answer here is this. That's not true here. For extracting the opcode, is that what you're thinking of, or? That's the least significant 4 bits. Since OXF has the least significant 4-bit set. They're already at the bottom of the number where we want to extract them to. That's what we need. So we also have the question about opcode here where we actually need to shift things. So the general pattern here is that if we wanted to get the higher bits, we need to shift by not 0. And if we wanted to get, we need to shift by something other than 0, like 4. But that's the general pattern. So in the code I give, we might do these operations in the other order. So you could first select the bits you want and then move them. That works too. And you should just reason about what happens to each bit. And I recommend writing out something like, if we have A, B, C, D, E, F, G, what happens on each, F, what happens at each step. So here, if we shift this over 0, we get the result is still A, B, C, D, F, G. If we AND that with O, X, O, F, which is 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, we get 0, 0, 0, E, F, G, H. And you can work it out by hand to figure out what happens in general and see which ones are, do what we want, even if they don't do the operations in the most logical order that I would write them in. Yes?
So in general, if I wanted to byte 1, I would
just do the instruction to the instruction. Because we have an unsigned care instruction here, because we have a pointer to byte. If you want the byte 1, yes. So if I gave you a pointer to something else, like an int, it would be different. It points to the first byte of the instruction, the place where the opcode is. Yeah, if I gave you a pointer to an int and had you access the instruction that way, you'd have to do something different. Yeah. So instruction one, the question was about what is instruction one, why are you doing that? Must access the second byte of the instruction, which is correct, because we have a pointer to a byte-wide value. Yes?
Is iCode and iFun just one bit or four bits?
These are each four bits.
So what we would access if we said instruction zero?
Yes, so you'd access this, this is what instruction, this is when instruction zero would access. Which would be the only thing in part of the instruction, like a not, for example. Okay. So, bitwise strategies. So, some general things. So, check if positive, negative values are allowed. Work bit by bit, Sometimes, so if we have something like X and Y, you can figure out what could possibly happen to each bit. So a problem like X and Y less than, you know, X or Y, you can figure out for each bit, you know, what are the possible values. So if X is, if a bit of X is zero and a bit of Y is zero, what happens on each side, and you can work through each bit. And if you, work bit by bit, and figure out what happens to the sign bit. So if the sign bit can change, that's going to do a lot of things. That will probably answer the question for you. If the sign bit is fixed for some reason, for example, maybe the question doesn't allow negative values to start out with, so the sign bit never starts set, then that will tell you a lot about what happens. So like in this example, you can say, that this is when X is zero, X is Y is zero, bit of X, Y is zero, then we have zero, zero. That's already a counterexample. You could also say that if they're both one, we have one versus one, one versus one. If one of them is zero and one of them is one in a bit, we have zero versus one. And from that, you can infer that this is less than or equal, if assuming the equal if sign bit doesn't change. Sign bit is zero. So if the sign bit's zero, that's less than or equal. If the sign bit's not zero, anything could happen. You're flipping the sign. Value changes by a lot. So that's one strategy. Look for counterexamples. So common things. If we have something like this, like X shifted over 2, you should ask what happens if all the interesting bits of X are shifted away. Can X be negative, for example? That's another thing to check. What happens if X is some negative number, like e.g. minus 1? And those will often find counterexamples, or working through them might help you figure out how you would know in general that something's always true. But, if something interesting is going to happen with a shift, it's when things get shifted off. If something interesting is going to happen with AND and OR, you can just work through the possibilities for a single bit, which is possible to actually do exhaustively. Another helpful thing to know is remember that minus X is equal to flipping all the bits and adding 1. So you can just do that substitution. So in a middle problem, and that will tell you what happens with either flipping all the bits, you can turn into negating a value, and that might be easier to reason about, or you can turn negating a value into flipping the bits and adding 1, and that might be easier to reason about what happens. So that's my short list of strategies. I guess I'll figure out what happens to the sign bit separately. assigned numbers. Separately, since that's, we'll often tell you what goes on directly. And someone asked about overflow. So this is, can values overwrite the sign bit? Values get out of range? Is the other sort of questions you should ask. And that's what overflow is. Overflow is like, I have x over 2, I ask you if x over 2 is less than x. So if x is signed, there's an easy answer here, which is we could shift into the sign bit. A 1 that wasn't there before. So x is signed, could, I guess this is, could overwrite sign bit with 1 from positive x. Because we could have, so that's something which could happen. And that is overflow. Since it doesn't do the multiplication we kind of expect, x is unsigned, could shift bits off the end, and won't be multiplication. So for example, if x only has ones in the top 2 bits, get 0. And that's the strategy of try to construct a counterexample by, you know, if you have shifting, do something, see what happens if the interesting bits get shifted off. This is a case where you get a much smaller value, even though that normally does multiplication. And when we're talking about overflow, we're just worried about things like this. You can also have it with like addition. If we have to carry something beyond the end of the number or into the sign bit, that's a problem. And you should think about, is that possible? Just try to reason, can we do that? If so, that probably makes the question easy to answer. Just caution, when we give these questions, pay attention to if we've like prevented overflow from happening by saying like the values aren't too big. Like, we aren't allowing those huge values which would cause overflow to happen, which is a nice thing to do and often how you reason about do things in reality. Okay. So any questions about sort of the bit manipulation, looking at that, figuring out whether things are possible? Okay, so I will try to go to thing. So list and C. So we have multiple types of lists. So we have sentinel terminated arrays. So these are represented by a pointer plus memory with space for n plus 1 values. We have ranges, which are represented by a pointer plus a length plus memory with space for n values. And we have linked lists, which are represented by a pointer, plus memory with space for, so n instances of memory with space for a value and a pointer. And the memory with space for parts of each of these is what's dynamically allocated. Everything else is stack on stack registers, etc. Needs to be stored, but we don't need to malloc it. We could just pass it directly if needed, or a pointer to it if we want to modify it like we did in the homework. So we have some disadvantage, so like the advantages and disadvantages of these come partly from how easy it is to get to a particular element, which you hopefully learned about in the past with like linked lists versus arrays, and partly from how much extra space we need and where we put it, whether we need to allocate it or whether we put it somewhere else, and partly from flexibility. So sentinel term arrays can't store everything because of the sentinel value. Everything else can. Yeah. So why does the linked list use the most memory? Because we have n times a value and a pointer. So as long as n is sufficiently large, it probably uses more space. And certainly more dynamically allocated space. I mean, it's not always true. Like if we have zero values, we just store a pointer and that might be a lot smaller. But as n gets large, we have all these pointers we're storing, which none of the other things have to do. Okay, y86 versus x86. So big things are one type of operands for each instruction, separate move instructions. I think those are all the notable differences. So one type of operands, which means add, only takes registers, for example. Yes?
For the reading code questions, are we going to get y86 or x86?
We could use either. We will tell you which one it is.
Okay.
We will never ask you a question like, here's some Y86 assembly code, but we're tricking you and it's actually invalid. That's not going to happen.
Okay.
Separate move instructions. So I think those are the only like big differences which come out. So there's one type of operands, add takes only registers, and remove queue only takes register plus displacement plus displacement register. You know, and all the other things with instructions. Where in real x86 we have tons of options, which we don't have in y86. So RISC versus CISC. So key idea is RISC simplifies hardware design. So this means fixed length instructions are common in RISC because that means easier to, you know, fetch, decode, etc. Because we don't have to ever worry about how long is the instruction. We know how long. We know where the next instruction is right away. You know, values in the same parts of instructions. So also easier to decode. So we don't have to ever worry about where is the register number this time. It's always in the same place. That's the sort of decision RISC would make. Fewer instructions, so easier to implement all parts of the CPU because less stuff to do. We'll have simpler instructions, so also easier to implement. So examples of simpler are few ways to specify operands. No doing computation and memory access in the same instruction. No writing multiple results from one instruction, like, you know, pop does, for example. And like all stuff. So avoiding these complicated instructions. So stack manipulation instructions like touch memory and also compute a value that is not just for accessing memory because they update the stack pointer. That's like not something that RISC processors like doing in general. It's less RISC-like to do. We also usually more registers way of using extra space in hardware. So since we aren't using all our space in our hardware for implementing more complicated instructions, more registers is a way to use it. Also, better performance, even though most instructions don't take memory operands. And using more registers makes it less bad that you can't specify add to a value in memory all the time. Because if you have more registers, you're less likely to need to send values to and from memory as much. Sort of makes up for having less ways of specifying operands. Okay. So any questions about y86 versus x86 and RISC versus CIS? Ternary operator. So the ternary operator is x question y colon z. This is equivalent to if x, y else z. But results in the value, which the if statement would do. I think that's everything I had. So, additional questions, things you'd like me to go over, follow ups? Yes? Spring 2017, which is about.
Finding buyer registers.
Finding.
Yeah.
Finding wedding registered values. Oh, reading Y86 code?
Yeah.
Okay.
And machine code.
Y86 and machine code. Okay. Any other? Okay. So question 9, spring 2017, which I should already have up over here. So question 9, so I think, okay. So I will, let's copy down this question to somewhere else so I can write things. So we have here. IR move Q 1 REX at address 0 and MR move Q from 0 RDX into RAX at address X and at 0x0 we got 30F0100 and at X we have 50020000. Okay, so this is what's the setup of the question is, and one of the questions is what is RAX after this? So first, let's reason through what this does. So RDX becomes 1, and then RAX becomes memory at the address of RDX plus 0, which is memory at address 1. So we're reading memory at address 1, which it is part of this machine code. So we have the hexadecimal that represents it, and that starts right here. This is address 1, this is address 2, address 3, and so on. And this is address 0. But this instruction, it would have a queue here, which means it's 64 bits, so it reads 8 bytes, starting with this byte, and moving on all the way up until till byte 8 of memory. So that's the value we're reading. We're taking all these bytes and producing an integer and a register from it. And our rule is always little endian this course. And if you didn't remember that, you will actually write this on the exam. So little endian means least significant byte at lowest address. So this F2 is the least significant byte, followed by this 01, 00, and so on. And that says hexadecimal, so the value should be, assuming I didn't copy this wrong or something like that, 1F2 in hexadecimal. Yes? So the order they're written, so the way I've shown you the instruction decoding is I've written each byte separately. And when we interpret that as a larger number and write it in English, it is in a different order. So within a register, there's no like notion of the order of bytes because there's no way of saying, give me the fourth byte of a register. It's just, we could write the register in multiple ways, but I wrote them down as sort of constants in C, and they'd be written in this way in C. Yes?
So RAS becomes the value that's stored in memory at position, and like at one?
Yes.
But why does it say 0x000? Why the first line? Should it be 0x001? Should that be memory location 1?
So what was it, where do you see, so let's go back to the question. So you're asking why does what say 00? This was not 20.
Number 9.
Number 9. No wonder I can't find it. Okay. So why does it say?
So like the very first line says 0x000.
So that is the address of the I remove Q instruction. The value before the colon is the memory address of the instruction listed after the pipe character. The hexadecimal values after the colon are the bytes of the instruction in the order they appear in memory. That's how you're supposed to know that. So, any other questions about this? Yes.
At what point does the little endianness happen? When I read the number from memory into the register, is it just copy straight from memory the way it is? Or, and then when I ask to interpret it, it does a little endian function?
So we have to, when we put a value, so in a register, we have a notion of a least significant bit and a most significant bit and all the bits in between. And in memory, we have notions that each byte has a number. So at that point, we need to make a choice of how the byte numbers correspond to what we put in registers, what we put in the register. That's where the choice gets made. And as I said, there's not a notion of the order things are stored in the register, because we can't actually say, hey, give me byte 4 of the register. That's not an operation that exists. So there's no actual notion that things are stored in any particular order in the register. There's just something which is least significant or most significant, like when we do an add. But there's not a numbering, which is what endianness is about. Endianness is about how does the numbering correspond to what's least or most significant. Yes?
What are the first two lines? Or what's the first byte, rather? At memory position 0, like 30.
That's 30 is the first byte. So 30, this is the first byte. This is the second byte, address 1. Third byte at address 2, and so on.
Yeah, I was just wondering what the first byte is for.
What's the first byte for?
Yeah.
This is an I remove Q instruction.
Okay.
And 3 is the I code.
Okay, so 5 would be the I code of MR with Q?
Yes, okay. Assuming that this question includes correct machine code.
Okay.
because we know everything is little endian, read in little endian in YD6. That's why we know we have to write it that way. And the options I gave in the question are all ways we write values in C, and we know that if we write OX1F2, the two is the, you know, ones place. That's how C values work. So, any other questions in my last 5 minutes here? Things you'd like me to go over? Yes? So, we could ask you about undefined behavior in C. So, first of all, undefined behavior, so what is it? Means compiler can do anything. Cases where people who defined what C is don't care. Don't care. And our, so example from lecture is x plus 1 overflowing, where x is signed. Compiler could, flowing. X plus 1 greater than x was an example. Because it's undefined behavior, the actual specification for the language doesn't say what to do in the case of signed overflow. Other common examples are anything that causes a seg fault is undefined behavior. That's why the compiler is allowed to have your code seg faults, because you did something you weren't supposed to do, typically accessing outside the bounds of an array. Bounds of array, reading freed memory, etc. Another example was shifting by more than the width of a value. Yeah?
The exam's in here during class time.
Okay, so logistics question, yes. Exam is, okay. That should not happen. Exam is, I didn't lose anything. Okay, I may have to edit my video. So the exam is here in class, during class time, 75 minutes. So any other questions in our last 2 minutes, or everyone set? Yeah. Sorry?
Yeah.
Sorry, I couldn't hear you, that's all.
Oh,
a pencil or pen. Pencil is fine. You could also use a pen, but I would recommend a pencil.